Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, and this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast for the week of February 16th. I'm joined this week by Professor James R. Kelly, Emeritus Professor of Sociology from Fordham University. Welcome, Professor Kelly.
Thank you.
Now, Professor Kelly has an article in this issue, one of a number we have about the new president and specifically taking on the question of abortion policy. I thought we could get started by discussing one of the main points of your article, which is the radical roots of the abortion movement. Maybe you can tell that story for our listeners.
The reason I was interested in doing the article was because it was pretty clear to me that Obama was going to win and the Democrats take over ascendancy, and what would this mean for the right to life movement? And it occurred to me, like any lasting movement, it would have to go back to its roots to revive itself, to find out what is its core, you know, that will moor it even as political regimes come and go. So since I've been researching the movement now for many decades, I went back to my early notes, and it occurred to me on several fronts. One is that one of the earliest criticisms in the early 1960s, so this was just when abortion was first even beginning to be discussed once again in the United States, and there was little thought of its legalization. It was the Catholic left, people like Tom Cornell, who immediately linked the core issue here that just like war indiscriminately takes life, abortion also takes life. And so that the person who was committed to one of the core principles of Christian discipleship should feel appalled that abortion was now becoming suggested as a solution, just as war is seen as a solution to conflicts between nations, and abortion seen as a solution to a conflict between a woman and the unborn child. So, and then that connection, the left opposition to abortion, continues long before Roe versus Wade becomes a reality. People in the peace movement, of course, know Gordon Zahn and one of the founders of Pax Christi. And early 1970, he even used the phrase, "We have to be consistent. You can't just oppose abortion. You have to oppose violence as a solution wherever you see it." And Zahn hit, I thought, on one of the key points there, namely that consistency is an abstract term, but it's necessary here, and we'll talk about Bernardine later. But for Zahn and the Catholic left, it meant integrity. This was the integrity of the witness. You can't just pick one violence and overlook the others. And it's no accident either, since the Catholic left was both rooted in nonviolence and rooted in the Catholic tradition. In fact, trying to, again, have the Catholic tradition retrieve the early Christian sense that militarism and discipleship, as the Sermon in the Mounts, don't really go together. And I always found it interesting that in the Second Vatican Council, and this was way before abortion was even an issue, if you look at the document Gaudium in Spes, the document written for the world, and number 27, if I remember correctly, abortion is mentioned, but it's the third of 27 items. It does begin with offenses against life, but it also includes things like horrible living conditions and lack of employment, and these are called infamies. So there was this sense of consistency and linkage right from the very start. And then I'm sure we'll go on and say, well, what happened to this linkage? So my article, in effect, is saying this election is an opportunity for the movement opposing abortion to go back to its roots and make linkages so that it can remain a vital witness in culture.
It seems like we have two strands here. One is progression from the Catholic left identifying the abortion cause as one of the prime issues to target. And then, you have this transformation from where now the pro-life cause is closely identified with the Republican Party. Now, obviously, almost 40 years have passed. So what exactly happened in the intervening years?
Can I tell you something, give you a fact that I think should make us think, too, about this return to roots? That when after Roe versus Wade was passed in 73, and then the political opposition to abortion rose, and one of the earliest opposition was Ellen McCormick from Long Island, housewife, Democrat, and she picks the Democratic. I mean, just shows you this grassroots vitality, this sense that abortion is not a good way to deal with awful things that happen to people. So she participates in 10 Democratic primaries. Nobody thought the Republicans would be the harbor for opposition to abortion because, as some of the people I interviewed said, the Republican Party stood for, bankers and golfers and low taxes and not really a concern for ordinary people, that the Democrats were the place for ordinary people. And Ellen McCormick had, none of these people were politically active apart from voting. It was this movement. So in that's the 76 election. And then most of the early Democrats, they, Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, Jesse Jackson, they all instinctively said, no, abortion is not the solution. So what happened? Well, several things happened. One of the first things that happened, I would say, is that the right that the Democrats at that point also their sort of if they had any central ideology, it was the equal opportunity, which was now taking cognizance of the women's movement, and the right to life movement at that time really, as opposed to now, did not really make the connection between support for the unborn and support for the woman. They had it instinctively because even before right-to-life political mobilization, there was a birthright and alternatives to abortion. These started in 1970 and 1971. So on the local level, helping women, but it wasn't in a way that made political connections in terms of obligations of a political party or obligations of the government. And then also the Democrats at that time, so prizing individual liberty and autonomy. I mean, they had lost the language of the common good, and frankly, trying to appear open to the demands and requirements of women. Plus the issue that in this election, Catholics had to deal with once again, that not everything bad and even really bad can be criminalized. The right to life movement at that time was insisting on all or nothing. Reverse Roe or we don't give you anything. And the Democrats couldn't go that far. Now it was Ronald Reagan, of course, and then the Republicans too, who realized at that time that they're never gonna win an election unless they can attract the ordinary people. And to truncate this pretty sharply for our purposes here, the fiscal conservatives, right, small government, low taxation, found it easy to court the social conservatives, pro-family, anti-abortion, because they realized that there was not really so much that they would have to do in return, because the courts were never going to, sophisticated people knew that the courts were not going to completely overturn Roe versus Wade. They were not going to criminalize abortion. I don't want to say that Reagan was not sincere, but I find it interesting that both Nancy Reagan and his daughter were pro-choice, same way in George Bush 1 and in George Bush 2. Both their wives and their daughters are pro-choice. So can you imagine, in that family, if they really thought that what their husbands were proposing, a recriminalization of abortion, was going to become a reality? So there was this tactical fit between the fiscal conservatives and the social conservatives. You can give them little things like George Bush did, like the Republicans always did, but you never had to deliver the whole thing, and you knew that. I'll give you an example. In this recent election, Douglas Kimiak.
Yes, from Catholic, from Pepperdine.
Pepperdine, right. Yeah. He originally was in Catholic University.
Catholic University.
Said, to speak succinctly here, that a Catholic could vote for Obama and not feel guilty for supporting abortion, using all of the complex legal and moral theology of formal cause and material cause. But here's my point. When Kimiak worked in the Justice Department under the Reagan administration, it was his desk in the beginning to formulate the challenges to Roe versus Wade. And Kimiak noticed two things, that wherever he had unborn, that would be rewritten by someone above him, and it would come back, they would scratch out the unborn, and it would only, it wouldn't refer to the status of the fetus at all, but just talk about the misreading of the Constitution. Now, this concerned Kimiak because he wanted not just this to be a process thing, he wanted it to be a substance thing because what was at stake was so huge. And then he also noticed that by the end of his term in the Justice Department, and that wasn't the Justice Department of the administration, he was out of the loop. They were no longer sending it to his desk. So the Republican Party, if you notice, has never disagreed with the premise that what is at stake at abortion is a developing human life that has equal claims on our community. And then just a second thought too, that if you look at the polls of those people who attend the Republican conventions, there's no surprise there that they would be far more wealthy and far more educated than the ordinary Americans. But also, they're far more likely than the population to support legal abortion. So there you have this clash between, on the platform, you know, the Republican presidents calling for a reversal of Roe versus Wade, saying at least we're going to work for this. But the delegates, if you did the statistical homework, they don't really support it. So there is that sense, you know, that this fusion of the fiscal conservatives with the social conservatives at this period of time really worked well for the Republicans. Now, that link, I think, is forever broken. In other words, the fiscal conservatives no longer will appeal to the social conservatives.
We'll address that issue in a little bit, but another strand that you kind of mentioned earlier that I'd like to bring up too is the church's stand on abortion, and of course has always been against abortion. And in 1964, as you note, in one of the documents of Vatican II, abortion was not singled out as one issue above the rest, but was third in an item of a list that included genocide and euthanasia. What has happened since then where it seems, at least among some groups in the church, that abortion is kind of listed as a first among equals, if you will?
Right. Well, first of all, I'd say there's, from the Catholic Christian view, there's many reasons to put it first among equals, in the sense that it's an obvious direct attack on life, and it involves person. Like, we can't start wars, but we can start abortions. So it appeals to that immediate sense of moral responsibility. So it's not a morally weird thing to say. But then when you think of abortion in terms of a legal issue, it immediately it makes more demands on our reason and on our faith, doesn't it? Because then we have to say, how do we translate this moral abhorrence for the direct, immediate taking of an innocent human life into a way that helps the community deal with abortion in a moral way? So that requires far more moral sophistication and far more political savvy, and most important, a far more ally to do that. Now, what happened to the church in this period? First, I would say that church, and we'll stay with the Catholic Church here in America, the link between abortion and, for example, other forms of nonviolence was never severed. I mean, it's really significant that in 1983, when the bishops concluded their several-year dialogue with their fellow Catholics and fellow Americans on the arms race and the MAD, mutual assured deterrence, in the pastoral document, The Challenge of Peace, in 1983, they expressly link, they say, the reason we're against abortion is the same reason we're against nuclear weapons, because each takes innocent human life. So there's a link there. And they also go on to say, we realize that many Americans do not share this, but it's our responsibility to try to make this linkage clear and persuade them. And if you look at all of the church documents that come out, they never do deny that. But it varies as to when it's emphasized and when it's minimized and when it's made to seem like abortion trumps all other issues. So now you have to look at what are some of the political and social factors that are related to losing that sense of what Bernardine came to call the consistent ethic of life, or a downplay. I say it's never lost. It's always there, but it's not really as prominent at all times. Well, one is the movement itself. I mean, the anti-abortion movement attracts, by the mid-70s and the Reagan era, I'd say the evangelicals are squeezing out the Catholics with their more sophisticated, consistent ethic of life. The evangelists are always go back to that, the moral priority of America, American exceptionalism. So that link, so your allies then in this all-important abortion debate at this time are no longer sharing or resonating with your consistent ethic of life. Much more to be said there, but here's a second thing which I think future historians and sociologists will reflect on. By this time, don't forget, in Catholicism, there's a coming to grips with what the Second Vatican Council really meant. Is it a spirit of renewal? Does it make for a really sharp break in terms of Catholic understanding? So questions of Catholic identity become more and more apparent. If you read the documents of Vatican II, there's a confidence there, and that Catholicism wants to reach out so as to bring about a world that is more humane. Maybe not more Catholic, but more human. By the 80s, that's not lost, but it's no longer an internal priority. And an identity does become really important. And opposition to abortion, while the rest of the world has gone permissive and valuing and making privacy a key value in civilization, well, my Lord. I mean, only the rich and the secure can survive on privacy. Well, to insist on opposing abortion, even at the risk of being considered unprogressive, well, that makes for a stronger sense of identity. So I think the cultural shift where identity problems become more prominent makes the consistent ethic of life, never goes away, is always there, but becomes diminished in terms of its use, its rhetoric, its resonance, its appeal.
Right. I mean, you mentioned the consistent ethic life, the seamless garment, which Cardinal Bernardine first proposed in a talk at Fordham University in 1984.
83. December 6th. I was there. I can tell you about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, maybe you can talk about it. I mean, you can see in that moment how much things had changed since maybe 20 years earlier at Vatican II, in that he puts this argument forward, and it becomes a subject of some controversy, in that there are some who say that this seamless garment is might be used by more progressive Catholics or perhaps politicians to justify a more lax stand on abortion. So maybe you can talk about that event and the reaction to it at the time.
Let me just describe being there, then I'll refer to several of the points that he makes, and then third, I will try to explain its pertinence for us today in the Obama era. First is when Bernadine was invited to Fordham, it was to give a Gannon lecture. It was about 5 months after the Challenge of Peace. And for the first time, and I had been at Fordham then for over a decade, and I faithfully went to all Gannon lectures, and this one was different. Newspaper men and photographers were there, and the lights were on, and the place was crowded, and there was a real hum about it. Why? Because everybody thought that Bernadine, because he had chaired the bishop's committee for the Challenge of Peace, which was a direct challenge to the Reagan administration. It was saying, the bishop said to the Reagan administration, mutually assured destruction as a principle of American security is morally wrong. So bishops standing up to a president, well, that's big deal. And of course, reporters are interested in such conflicts. And then Bernadine astonishes everybody because he doesn't talk about the pastoral challenge of peace. He talks about abortion. Well, you just looked around and everybody was, you know, just stunned. I don't recall looking around to see if the reporters just left the room. But even then, you know, as a young sociology teacher, it was clear to me, I knew it before, that, you know, to be against abortion was just not very interesting, not very progressive, didn't link to anything else. So, and yet this was what Bernadine was trying to do, you know, like the Vatican Council said, that, you know, no, integrity requires that we look askance at any attempt to use violence as a solution, either on the national level or on the personal level. Secondly, like if you read that, what he said, first of all, the title of it is A Consistent Ethic of Life, A Catholic and American Dialogue. So he stresses dialogue there. He knew that what this connections that he's making between the different forms of violences went against common sense and political savvy and even people's ordinary moral judgment. They just weren't there yet. In other words, to sound parochial, the Catholic tradition just went deeper on these issues than everybody else. And the Catholic tradition has always stressed the comprehensiveness, the linking together, not looking at things in isolated. It wants to be a way of life, not just for individuals, but also for culture. So to get back to the point, if you read Bernadine carefully, what he says still stands. For example, he says that we can't have it both ways. We can't say that we're against abortion and then do nothing to help mothers or change the society so that abortion becomes less likely. He also says that we have to be visible so that people see us, not just as naysayers, but as actively engaged. And then third, he doesn't deny the importance of law. He says so that we can change the law. But if you notice, right after he says change the law, go back and read that, he says so that the law is changed and it's supported by a national consensus. In other words, what Bernadine is saying is that, to use a familiar phrase, that no hearts and mind, no law. I mean, it has to be built on this moral persuasiveness before the law can take hold. And then he spent almost a year going around, because there was, as you say, a lot of opposition to that. And he also, in the Gannon address, says he realizes that even as we have to persuade others, he says our commitment does come from religious commitment, but we have to translate it into terms that would when the hearts and minds, he doesn't use hearts and mind, which would win the consensus of the nation. And he says, we're far from doing this with Catholics. And then he went around, he was invited, for example, to give an address at the National Right to Life Convention. When I interviewed Bernardine, I said, how did that go? He said, well, wasn't so bad, it wasn't so good. He said, he just looked and it seemed half clapped and half sat on their hands. So the primary, most visible social movement organization against abortion knew that, you know, what Bernardine was asking was very difficult for them to do as a quasi-political organization. So Bernardine goes around the country giving these are collected in a Loyola Press volume. And he says, you know, he can see, you can't do everything in a life. He can see people just devoted to contesting abortion, and he can see people just contesting militarism. He says, but all he's asking for is that they keep in touch with each other, that they watch each other, that they acknowledge each other. So there was, in the Bernardine address, both a moral, a political, and a social movement complexity that was just lost, not only by opposition to abortion, but by the political parties and by some church people, and including some bishops.
Well, I thought we could kind of end on the point that you had suggested before, which was kind of bringing it back around to today and looking at the question of, as you say, now seems like a time to return to these roots, these radical roots of the abortion movement.
Right.
So what would you recommend to pro-lifers, Catholics or otherwise, who are now under a newly elected Democratic president?
First of all, I would say require Obama to be consistent and show integrity on his own terms. I mean, that's the start of any dialogue. And if you read, for example, in Audacity to Hope, where he has about 5 or 6 pages on abortion, I mean, it's typical Obama, you know, full of nuance and all. But that's what it is, full of nuance. He says, I should have brought the text here, but you can check it. He understands why people think that abortion is not a good thing, that it should not just be blindly considered a human right, that it's very complicated. And he doesn't want to lose that moral sense. So, and then of course Obama, when his whole campaign was, he finally accepted the principle of Democrats for Life. I mean, the Democrats for Life, which formed after the Kerry defeat, realizing that you just can't be blind to people's feeling that abortion is not a good thing and should not be considered just a human right. You could see it being decriminalized or reluctantly accepted until we can do something better as a civilization. But to see it as a long line of progressive developments of the highest human civilization. Well, Obama says no, he can understand why people don't want to do that. So you hold him to consistency in terms of the Democrats for Life. Once you do that, there are some common ground things that can be done that keep the moral abhorrence of abortion and the distinction between seeing it as something progressive and seeing it as something reluctant in a culture, it can be done. And the Right to Life movement, I think, has shown great tactical imagination here. If you look at what they're trying to do, say, especially on the state levels, for example, things like try to make sure that women seeking abortion have, if they are willing to look at sonograms of the fetus. Make sure that the choice is informed. Make sure that the women realize that there are alternatives. And in terms of, and you could even build on what Bush tried to do, faith-based communities. Look at those groups and well help them in terms of getting resources and getting some sort of public visibility, I would say. And Obama also creates the great possibility in terms of political rhetoric, because if you look at statistical polls about approval for abortion and opposition for abortion, blacks are far more likely than whites, generically, to say, I'm against abortion. But if you look at the abortion rates, black women are three times more likely than white women to have abortion. Well, it doesn't require sort of a democratic gene or socialist gene to say, well, part of the difference there is that black women don't have the resources to do what their morality is asking them to do. So you have to have more resources made available to them. So in other words, the movement, the Right to Life movement, is going to continue its these tactical things to make them even more visible, and to challenge Obama on them in his own terms will keep abortion alive in the culture. But for me, while that's really important, it still doesn't take the opposition to abortion back to its roots, namely that, you know, and not only is taking of innocent life in the womb an evil, bad thing, but also taking the lives of human beings while nation states, in the name of security, use overwhelming military force, well, that too is an affront to our humanity. In other words, yes, let's make abortion no longer a human solution, semicolon. Let's also make war no longer the alternative to human problems.
Well, we will end there, but we want to thank Professor James R. Kelly from Fordham University for talking about this difficult and complicated issue, but I think really shed some light on it for us. I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Reminder that you can respond to our conversation by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. Also like to thank Bill McGarvey, who provides the music for the show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.